Grab a seat, and hopefully you've got a Bible. We're going to look at Genesis a little bit more today, a little bit in the Ecclesiastes. So we'll actually get out of the first book of the Bible, which is rare on a class like this. But I love days like this. I love the cool weather, the trees starting to color. It's like, this is my paradise. No snow yet. All right, let's play and then we'll get to work. Father, thank you that you've set up a rhythm of work and rest, and today's one of those days where we can rest, even though it means our minds are going to be filled and hopefully overloaded in a good way. But make that really refreshing for us, that we would be charged up to live the rest of the week for your glory. Please put your hand on this class as we look at how the fall twisted work. Would you please give us clarity and show us how a robust view of what happened there really helps us as we consider the frustrations of work now. Thank you that that's not the end of the story, that there's a Redeemer, and because Christ came, work no longer is ultimate. You've come to, in the realm of our tasks, you've also come to undo more and more of the burden and make it more of a joy. Keep us from the tyranny of work. We ask these things, praying again for your blessing on the class, in Jesus' name, amen. All right, first order of business, shut down the cell phone. It will pay off later during the sermon. All right, so I want to start with review. If you remember, we're talking about work and leisure. And as we defined work and leisure in the first class, work is really the things that you're obliged to do, the things that God has called you to do that you've simply just got to do. You've got to do laundry, so that's part of your... Yeah, I think that's fair. You've got to do laundry. That's part of your obligation task, also your job. A leisure, on the other hand, is that which is not obligation, but that which is fulfilling, which builds up, which strengthens. If I could review that little... that I wrote or stole from Philip Ryken, it's the crucial life space for expression and development of self. So doing puzzles is part of leisure. Reading a good book is part of leisure. Crafting, maybe you're a potter and you craft stuff like that. That's all part of leisure. There are other parts of leisure. Maybe gardening is leisure for you. So that's the idea of work and leisure. It's a reminder that work is not simply your labor, what you're paid to do, but all the obligations that we have. Last week we looked at work before the fall, and I find that delightful because God Himself is a God of work. He works. He worked 6 days, and what that does is it elevates our work. If God Himself is a worker, He gets His hands dirty, as it were. Then all work is honorable. There's a dignity in all work, whether it's manual or intellectual work. So God Himself works. Work, that was the theme of last week. I should have said that first. But God gave work as a good gift, meant for our pleasure, our joy, to love our neighbors with and to magnify Him with. So we reflect Him. That's another little bit as we race through this review. The image of God in our work. Where God made us in His image, and that little verse there is sandwiched between God's working and creating, and then His call for us to work. So part of the image then is to reflect God's working in creating things, in ordering things, in adding structure and building things, loving, filling, shaping, constructing, to mention a few more. And we look briefly at God's design and work, that it's for our good, it's for our joy. And we came up with a whole list of things where work satisfies. There's a joy in standing back when you've written a piece of music and you heard it sung. You're going, that's good. Just like God takes that seventh day and reflects on and joys. Work has that element. To not work would sap us of a lot of satisfaction. There's, I don't know if this is true of you, but there's nothing like coming in from working hard outdoors and you're sweating, as they say, like a pig. And you just, there's something good. I've worked hard. And you jump in the shower and you feel great. There's that satisfaction that comes along with much of work. And we saw that in many elements in working together, in seeing the work of our hands. And then what else was there? for the purpose of work, work is God's good design. It's not part of the curse. That's basically what I just said. Then the purpose of work is to honor God by loving our neighbor. Loving our neighbor and serving them through your work. You might say that God's hands are used to bless others through our hands. That God uses, the instruments He uses to give you your daily bread is through the labor that He's called us to, where it's the farmer and the harvester and the guy who, gets the moisture off the grain, and then they back to the bleacher if you use bleached flour, and we can get to a nice debate about that, and then the baker, and then the guy who brings it. All those things are God's hands using the ordinary means of work to bring us our daily bread. So that's a little review of what we looked at last week. Today I want to look at work twisted, work after the fall. Because work takes a significant nosedive in Genesis chapter 3. So first, before we get to what did change, what didn't change? When the fall happened, did God cancel work? It would have been nice. No, instead work became a burden. But what didn't change is that the fall isn't what introduced work into the world. It was already there before. And so I think that's significant to hold on to, because so often we think work is tied to the curse. Well, part of it's tied to the curse. And the fall didn't change work. It didn't cancel work as a duty imposed by God either. We're still called to continue working after the fall. That didn't change. And even God's good design is still there. Many of the bits we talked about last week of the satisfaction and the joys of work are still here, at least elements of it. Might not be as full. Those things are culled back, but they're still there. There's still that goodness of the design. There's still the imaging of God in our work. Those things carry on, and yet they're all twisted. So what did change? That's getting to point two. That's where we're going to spend most of our time today. See if any hands. No hands. I'll keep going. The new element, if you speak in broad strokes, is that work now is under curse. It's a punishment that people bear as a burden. So the idea of burden, that you're weighed under, that's what's new with the fall. Instead of fulfillment, now we move to frustration. We'll see that in Genesis chapter 3, where there's sweat involved, there's pain involved. Now there's resistance to that which we work with. It's sort of fighting back. The garden you plant fights back with setting up these weeds and these bugs that chew up your delicious tomatoes. Our rose bush got killed by the curse. Caterpillars. So now there's burden, there's weariness. That's the broad stroke of what happened with the fall into sin. So maybe look there for a moment. Where's my Bible? Chapter 3, Genesis 3. Let's look at verse 16. I want to first look at how the woman's work got twisted. Genesis 3, 16. So right after the fall, God comes to his people, to Adam and Eve. And he gives them a great promise of the gospel, and yet the results of the fall are very clear. It's not that he's just going to fix everything. They're going to live under curse. So verse 16, to the woman he said, I will surely multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. That's a lot we could get into there as far as what are women allowed to do and not. That's not really where I want to go with this. You just read Proverbs 31 and that'll sort of fill this out a little bit further. But one of the main tasks or significant tasks of women is the whole aspect of household bearing children. That's God called Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply. So a significant aspect of that is for Adam and Eve to do so. And yet instead of that being a straight joy, it now is associated with pain. I don't want to go into a whole lot of details about that pain and ripping and blood and so on, but you get the idea where I think it's not hard to see how bearing children is no longer straight joy. There's joy. You forget the pain after the little one's born. They're squirming or squawking, gurgling in your arms. We'll make it a positive word. But there's now pain associated with that work. It's called work. Work and toil are the same word almost in every language. A labor, toil. Interesting. You go into labor. Well, it's toil. There's a twist here from bearing children in joy, now bringing forth children with sorrow and pain. Um, So I think you can extrapolate a little bit on that. That work in the home is subject now to frustration. And I think you see that in many of the household tasks even with kids. Kids can die. And often, especially in years gone by, they did. There was a real immediate pain in the work of having a family. And there's a real sorrow there. Kids can rebel. They can refuse to listen to discipline. All that frustration, the whole household realm, the task of parents is subject now to frustration and difficulty. Parents can be most frustrating. But it's not just that. If you look at the second phrase here in verse 16, I'll surely multiply your pain in childbearing. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. There's a lot of debate over exactly what that means, but I think what you could easily say is even the realm of relationships now are frustrated by the fall into sin. Relationships and love become work, and there's hard work that goes into them. And even though you might be most faithful or most caring or loving, it's not always reciprocated. There's that twister where you're called to work your relationship, but it's no longer simply straight joy. Where Adam and Eve walked in fellowship and joy, now it becomes frustration and pain. God interestingly ties the pain of love and marriage with the pain of work. Love and work can become difficult. The results of our work sometimes die quickly, just like our children may, or used for terrible things. And if you think in terms of this relationship, I find it interesting that it's a curse on work, and then right in the middle is that relationship idea. I think Kim mentioned a while ago that her frustration with work isn't so much Kim Hanlon. The work itself, she enjoys work, but it's the relationships that she works with, the people that she works with. You see how work in a relationship, if work is to love our neighbor, and now that's under curse, a lot of our work's not going to be received well. But when we try to do things well, they don't see it, they don't appreciate it, they might throw it back in our face. Even the relational aspects of work are under frustration and curse. And you think in terms of employer-employee, where the employers are now prone to using their employees, or employees are frustrated with their bosses because they're not getting what they want, and they can easily sabotage and so on. In a minute here. I find this really interesting. The Larger Catechism touches on this, believe it or not. It touches on all kinds of things you wouldn't expect. But it talks about this idea of the relational aspect of work being frustrated. And it asks it this way. What are the sins of inferiors against their superiors? This is I forget which commandment it is, but honor your father and mother. Is that the fifth? Tell me it's the fifth, somebody. All right, very good. And the idea is those who are under, like employees, to their superiors, the employers. The sins of inferiors against their superiors are all neglect of the duties required toward them, envying at, contempt of, rebellion against their persons and places in their lawful counsels, commands, corrections, cursing, mocking, here's a good word, and all such refractory and scandalous carriage, carrying on, as proves a shame and dishonor to them and their government. But it flips it the other way, too. And I think you can see this here under the curse in Genesis 3, the relational aspects of work. What's required of superiors toward their inferiors? So it puts it the other way. No, I want what are the sins of? I'm sorry. What are the sins of superiors? So now talk about bosses or those in authority over folks. Well, it's the neglect of the duties required of them. An inordinate, a not appropriate seeking of themselves, their own glory, ease, profit, or pleasure. Commanding things unlawful, or not in the power of inferiors to perform, counseling, encouraging, or favoring them in what's evil, discouraging, discountenancing, correcting them unduly, so being harsh, and so on. I think you see that there in Genesis 3, where the relationship is twisted. Your desire shall be for your husband, so there's an envying of the one put over her. And on the other hand, he shall rule over you. And the implication seems to be a hardness. Instead of a loving servantness, sure, you get it. There's a domineering and a using for self. And that's carried out in all the realms of work. I'm going to pause there for just a moment, because that's about what I wanted to say about how the woman's work gets twisted. We'll move on to the man. Any comments? Yeah, today's a heavy day. It's all curse, right? The twistedness. Go ahead, Betsy.
I'd actually like to differ with you about...
You're not allowed to differ with me.
Okay, you see, then lie. Anyway, I got the impression from it, you were saying that childbearing now has pain, but looking at the verse, it says, God, during the curse, he will greatly increase. So if he's greatly increasing something, that means that there might have been, just like there was work before, there's probably some, just had to be discomfort.
Right.
Childbearing.
Right.
Or minimal pain, but now it's
hard. Right, greatly exacerbated. Right.
So I feel like there was something associated with that he had to greatly increase it.
There
right.
Wasn't any childbearing.
Well, there wasn't, but obviously it was possible. but I reflected briefly on that, and I'll greatly increase it. It assumes at least that if Adam and Eve had children before the fall, that there would have been some pain or some degree of it. And I like to think of it in terms of discomfort, stretching, but different from ripping and bleeding. So greatly increase the pain. I suspect Adam may have sweat too, but not the harshness of the resistance of creation. So I don't know exactly how far to go with that, but there may have been at least, I don't know, passing a watermelon, they say. That's got to be at least uncomfortable, even if you're designed for it. You could even think in terms of animals. I don't want to draw too much of a comparison to that. Did I say things I shouldn't? I'm sorry. That's what Laura tells me. Just imagine this. I'm like, oh, no thanks. Now you're all imagining it. Where was I going? It's your fault. Let me just hit one point for a moment, Michael, and then I'll get your question. In terms of, I think of a deer giving birth. Does a deer experience pain? Well, I don't think animals have the same idea of pain. They give birth. It's natural. It's not, I'm sure it's not fun, but it's not the pain of curse like humans experience. That's, I don't know if that's a great example, but that's kind of what I think of when I think of greatly increased pain. Boy. Yeah, change the topic for us, Michael.
I don't know if I'm going to change the topic, but I think that you said a lot of very important things. But I think there is a fundamental principle here that it's missed by a lot of people, and that is that, you pointed out that God said to Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, and, he never rescinded that after the flood. He did the same thing to Noah. And, you made a very important point over and over again. God instituted work before the fall. So, man who does not provide for his own is worse than the ugly. And so the fundamental area of man, the male, is to work, to provide for his family. And the fundamental arena of the female is to bear children. God said to build the earth, and obviously the man can't do that without his wife. And so in the curse, after man falls, then those are the two areas that God does curse. So now the work, as you said, is there's thorns and thistles. And, maybe if man did sweat, I don't even know if he did or not. But the thing is, it's now much more difficult. There's pain involved. There's an aspect to it that's no longer pleasant. I mean, remember they were naked, and so the garden must have been a very nice temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And yet now that's all gone. Mm-hmm. And in the same way with women, as you were saying, it might have been a little bit unpleasant to bear a child, but it certainly was not the labor and intensity that to multiply something, it's really to increase it. So the point is, it is much more painful now.
Right.
But, and then on the other hand, and on the negative side, you see how that's totally, we always are trying to do things our own way against God's way. We don't want to work. A lot of men would rather have their wife work. A lot of men would rather turn the responsibility of the head of the home over to their wives. And they do that. Women say, I'm not going to have any kids. And they don't. So we see that we're rebellion against the things that God's ordained. Marriage is a good example. People say, I don't want to get married. And so they don't. Or homosexuality today in our own culture. We even have churches endorsing it, saying it's okay. And so in every single area, we try to take things in our own hands and do it opposite of the way that God says,
right.
That we get into trouble. And even though it's more painful, doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to do it. Man still is responsible to work, even though now there's thorns and thistles. And
right. I want to pick up on some of that, and probably in our last point, as far as the when man is ejected from the garden, the fellowship with God and God's good design is no longer followed. I want to be careful to limit the things here as the only tasks of women or men. They're broader. I think they're symbolizing all of the tasks or the work that we're called to, and yet that is God's original design, and yet not all even are called to it. Jesus never married, neither did Paul, as far as we know. But let me move on to the second aspect. Look in verse 17 and 18, 19 of chapter 3. We look at the curse on man's work, or how man's work got twisted. So Genesis 3:17, and to Adam he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten of the tree of which I command you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you. In pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Again, you see a very strong parallel there with the pain now in man's work. Curses your work in pain, in sweat, in labor you'll produce on the ground. So the sweat of your face, he's moved from being a gardener to a farmer now, where a gardener does some cultivating and quickly bears the fruit. Now you've got to farm, you've got to till the ground, you've got to fight the weeds, you've got to spray your pesticides, if you do such things, which I do. One fellow says, man was meant to be a gardener, but by reason of his sin, he became a farmer. And you see that in the skinned knuckles, in the sweat and the blood that comes along with our work. Now, Keller writes in his book, Every Good Endeavor, he explains that this idea of tilling the ground, it doesn't mean that we're all supposed to be farmers. That could be interesting. I think there's even a movement back toward that. But anyways, he says, gardening represents all our labor and culture building. And therefore, this statement for all, this is a statement that all work and human effort will be marked by frustration and a lack of fulfillment. Part of the curse is frequent fruitlessness. You get that idea, I think, fruitlessness from the thorns and the thistles. It's not as lavish and rich of a production as it once was. Now you get, you plant beans and you get thistles. The fall explains why there is such frustration and fruitlessness in our work. I want to just pause on that for a moment. There's a lot more I could probably say, but you might, if you don't like your work, is that bad? If you find work frustrating, is that okay? Yeah.
I think our modern society would say no, that you need to find a good job that brings you blissful joy every moment.
Mm-hmm. So I think today people would say, no, you should find a job that's going to give you absolute and unstopping joy and bliss. And there's something good of that. I think we ought to long for that type of work where we can enjoy our work. But when you don't get it and you can't find other work or you're just not given that opportunity or you just called these particular roles, Karen will give us the answer. Is it all burden? Are we allowed to be frustrated?
I think there's an element that's good to satisfaction, actually, because that shows us that we're not in a perfect place and that there's something better to look forward to. Mm-hmm. Because if I was in that supremo job that was so satisfying and wonderful, then I'd be like, I don't have anything to look forward to. It's better than that. Mm-hmm. But it also gives me this vision of something that is better within my workplace, where I can bring God's blessing and attention into that workplace and say, this is dissatisfying. There's something wrong with that. I can pray into it. I can bring His presence into there. Maybe there's something that just needs to be broken down, like maybe some strongholds or something, where, like you said, that's part of the fall, and I know that He's more powerful, like that Jesus has already broken me. So I can come into that workplace and say, all right, God, how can you use me as that vessel to, like, bring some change into the workplace, where maybe I don't see it immediately, but I know that He has the power to change that workplace.
Good. We ought to be looking forward, not only to class number, I think it's 7 or 8, of work in the new heavens and the new earth, but that's part of it. And what it helps with is it sets your expectations. You should expect that there's going to be an element of frustration in your work, and it shouldn't undo you. Because work isn't ultimate. God is ultimate. And that's, we'll get to that in a couple of classes, but that really begins to free you from some of the frustration. Because if work is meant to be perfect, oh joy, oh bliss, oh happy day, and it's not, what do? Jump off a bridge? Keep trying to find other jobs and then find other jobs? Or can you be at peace with, you know, this isn't how it's supposed to be. It's not how it's always going to be, but this is where it is right now. And I can continue to work even though this is difficult and frustrating. I can accept that as part of the curse. This is the way things are in this fallen world. And I can continue to magnify God by continuing to be faithful in a job that, or a task that I find difficult. I think that in some way that's freeing. Instead of saying, well, work must be pleasing all the time. Now, if you're in that job, let me know. I'd like to hear about it. I'm pretty close, in my opinion. Let me see if there's more I wanted to say there. No, I think that's about it for now. I want to look briefly back at verse 17 for a minute, because it's not just man and woman, but even the ground is cursed. Because of their fall, cursed is the ground. It's going to bring forth thorns and thistles. And I think the upshot of that is that work has become toil. There's a resistance to all that we do. I'm sure you've seen this as kids have lawns. You might want them to be green and to grow. But there's a resistance from the lawn itself. It's in rebellion against you. It brings up these little crabgrass stuff, or gets really sparse. It won't grow like you want it to. And you do all that you can to, but there's a resistance to your work. You clean your house, and what happens half an hour later? It's a disaster again. Or you make something. Maybe you develop cell phones, but they die after 3 years, or they're obsolete 3 months after you've developed it. There's a frustration to work that's because the ground itself now is cursed. It fights back. No longer will humanity always gain reward for harsh labor. We work in a hostile environment, and the creation itself groans under that, says Romans. That's just a minor point, but realize that because of the fall to sin, what you make is broken already. It has that tendency to chaos and brokenness. Go ahead. This is a negative picture today, but that's reality. Yeah. Yeah, right. 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 Yeah, I find that's very striking. And the reason is right back here. It shouldn't surprise us. I'm going to move a little further then, unless... No, I'm not seeing any hands. So let's go on to number 4. Then the last point, really, I think the biggest point. It's on the back of your page. Work for God gets twisted. That's, I think, the biggest deal of the fall is that the purpose of work now is twisted. Instead of work being designed to love our neighbor and to glorify God, it gets all gnarled and twisted and bent. It's broken. Where apart from redemption in Christ, work often becomes ultimate. It becomes the purpose of life, or it becomes our identity. Work is twisted for our own purposes, and we step on others to get ahead. So let's look for a moment. I based part of this on just the broken relationship you see in Genesis 3. I'm going to start here. Genesis 3, well, let's start at verse 19. I find something ironic here. Genesis 3, by the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. I find something really striking there, where man is formed from the dust, and he works hard all his life, and he returns to dust. You can almost hear Ecclesiastes kind of jumping up and down on that particular text. There's a pointlessness. You work and work and work, and then just become part of the ground that you're trying to produce crops out of it, and then you become part of it. And that's part of the brokenness of the relationship with God, where work becomes pointless in some sense. Look over in Ecclesiastes for a minute, chapter 2. This is a chapter that really opens that wide. Ecclesiastes, oh, that's nice, it opened right up to it. You usually have to find Ecclesiastes. Right after Proverbs. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. This idea of futility or vanity, a life under the sun. So apart from relationship with God, what can work do? What is work? Well, it's mostly frustration. We'll start at verse 17 and then go to 18 and I guess read most of that chapter. Chapter 2, verse 17 of Ecclesiastes. So I hated life because what is done under the sun, and that's code for life apart from God, what was done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and is striving after wind. And he specifies in work. I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he'll be a wise or a foolish man. Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all of the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. I can't help but read verse 24. It just points you to life above the sun, life in light of who God is. There's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. Well, how'd you get there? Well, this also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? Even when your work is realized, you set out to do something, you do it well. Let's say you set out to have a successful business, and it works. You're like, yes! There's still a pointlessness to it. Because who inherits it? You know, the little ditty, I've never seen a U-Haul behind a hearse. It just doesn't, you can't take it along. So there's an inherent futility to work. You get your garden all nice and done, and then you're gone. Then what? This happened in Grand Rapids. Dale and I planted this big garden, had a tractor and everything. It was lots of fun. 2 years later, it was all weeds. Weeds taller than I am. There's a pointlessness to so much of the work that we do, especially in light of death. That's part of the curse. That even when things go really, really well, there'd be a pointlessness. Work cannot by itself deliver a meaningful life. But I want to shift back to Genesis, but with the idea of work as alienation. Work alienates from God. Again, apart from new creation, apart from Christ, we're alienated, and our motives for working are twisted. There are many more places we could go than just here. But in verse 23 of chapter 3, the Lord God sent him out of the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he was taken. So now it's working the ground, but outside of the garden. He drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden, he placed a cherubim and a flaming sword that turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. So he's out of life. Now he's into death territory, if I could put it that way. And the significance of that, he's out of the presence of God. And what the curse has done to work is it's twisted that relationship, that our work, our life, our callings are made to please Him. And with that relationship broken, all of our work unravels. We begin to live against the grain of how we were designed. Some of the things that Michael was talking about. So the curse twisted the worker's ability to work or image for God. That's why I say work apart from God. Work for God gets twisted. Work to the glory of God gets busted up. Think of, look over in Genesis 11 for a minute at the Tower of Babel. I think you see this played out a little bit further there. As you look at Genesis 11, why did the guys build the tower? Why did they build the Tower of Babel? Babel.
Pride and vanity.
I don't know who said it from over here. I heard an echo. I heard it here and then echoed over by Brian. But yeah, pride and vanity. What's the gist of that? Was to build a name. They wanted an identity so that everybody could see them. Not see God, but see them. I think it's one of the pictures of how we twist. They worked hard. Now they had bricks. They got together and they built the wonderful big tower. But what was the point? To prove that they were something. That's one of the biggest ways that work gets twisted, where we work to be a success, to get a reputation, or to get money so that we can what? What does money actually do? It buys you status. It buys you toys. It's what money's after that is what really counts. And so the idea of a name, a status, today, I think this is Ryken. Many people define themselves by the status of their work. Tim Keller. He quotes a whole bunch of statistics on how people choose jobs today, particularly the younger generation. And part of it is it cool? Is this a cool job? Do I get to work for Apple? Is it profitable? Why profitable? Because it gets you into a certain lifestyle. And that's what you're after. It has nothing to do with your gifts or your talents. And one of the problems with that is it immediately puts you in a position where you can be frustrated like crazy. Because if your talents and gifts don't line up with the work that you want to do, you're not going to enjoy it. If your main goal is being cool and being profitable, you miss much of the joy and the purpose that God designed work for. It's not about your identity, first of all. This recipe for dissatisfaction and meaningless. And the other part of the Tower of Babel is it underlines the idolatry of man. So that everybody could come to see us, and we're going to build this tower so that its top is up in the heavens. We become God. That's another significant part of the twisting of work. What's an idol? What's imagining or trusting anything to deliver the control, security, significance, satisfaction, or beauty that only God can give. Think about that. Think about that and whatever task you have in front of you. Imagining or trusting anything to deliver the control, security, significance, satisfaction, or beauty that only God can give. You turn a good thing into an ultimate thing. And as soon as you do that, your task is frustrated. You move into comparison mode very quickly from there. If work must give you your security, you must work a lot. You have to. You can't move into leisure. You just can't. Because you need that security. If it's for power, you want to control your life. Same thing. Work becomes twisted. I don't know how far I want to go here. I think this is probably fairly clear. But think about that. Where's your work? One of the reasons I was looking forward to this particular class or the whole work session, but I think it's useful because it sends a warning shot across the bow. What's your motive? How are you and what you do? How is that purpose for your work twisted? You gotta watch out for that. Why are you doing what you do? Last week we saw what our work is meant to be. It's meant to love our neighbor. It's meant to glorify God. Is that functioning in what's set before you? We need to keep both of those in balance, both the fall and the pre-fall mandate for work. We understand there's frustration, but watch out for the idolatry. And we want to bend that back toward what's God's design. It's meant for the good of those around us, to serve them, and to please Him. I'm going to just do a little closing, and then I'll see if there's any questions on this. Tim Keller writes on this idea of idolatry. So Every Good Endeavor, it's one of the books in the syllabus. It's because of the nature of God's creation, we need work for our happiness. And because of God's intentions for our work, to contribute to the flourishing of the world, we have glimpses of what we could accomplish. But because of the fall of the human race, our work is also profoundly frustrating. Never as fruitful as we want, and often a complete failure. Here's especially what I wanted you to hear. This is why so many people inhabit the extremes of idealism and cynicism, or they ricochet back and forth between those two poles. Idealism says, through my work, I'm going to change things, make a difference, accomplish something new, bring justice to the world. Cynicism says, nothing really changes. Don't get your hopes up. Do what it takes to make a living. Don't let yourself care too much. Get out of it what you can. Christians have, through their hope in God's story of redemption for the world He created, a deep consolation that enables them to work with all their being and never be ultimately discouraged by the frustrating present reality of this world in which thorns grow up when they're trying to coax up other things. We accept the fact that in this world, our work will always fall short. In this world, our work will always fall short, just as we sinners always fall short of the glory of God. Because we know that our work in this life is not the final word. It's really a hint forward. Our work is not the final word. Frustrating, but not final. Not ultimate. The final word we'll see is the glory of God as Jesus comes back to renew that broken bond. We had a couple of minutes for questions. I feel like there might be a couple. I might have one for you. No? Yep.
I guess this is yes. I kind of think of King Solomon. And I thought, well, his father, King David, showed him, the youngest, he's his future king. And here it seems like you have Solomon complaining about who's going to take over the kingdom. And he's got all these sons, like, what, hundreds potentially, that he could have chosen from, instead of saying, oh no, I'm going to have like somebody take over my kingdom and they're going to do a bad job after me. They chose a homo, but he had all, it seems like he never cultivated an heir. You know, that he followed God and then he didn't follow God.
Mm-hmm.
And if he had continued following God, God would have showed him the right heir to the kingdom. I guess I kind of, I think about that as the Christian life. Like when we keep our eyes on God, if He shows us the right direction to go in the midst of the fall, I guess
I guess I find it easier to go with David for a minute because David had a whole bunch of sons too, but I'm not sure I would have wanted to pick very many of them. When you look at their track record, I think that's part of the idea of the futility of work. Your kids are wonderful. But if you could look down and see 50 years from now or 70 years from now, or their children, and what they do with how you've gifted them and served them, you might be rather frustrated. You know, I didn't teach you that. That's not the way I wanted you to go. I think that's the idea of Ecclesiastes, where we work hard. And the Proverbs even say you should store up a treasure or inheritance for your sons, if possible kind of thing, to help them along, or your daughters. And yet you can't control what they're going to do with it. And that's the idea of Solomon's frustration. But you're right, as we serve, as we live above the sun, as with our eyes fixed on God, we could say, you know what? I can't control what they're going to do. I'll work hard, I'll teach them well, and I'll entrust it to the Lord. And that frustration is not going to completely consume you, even if they don't live as you want them to. kind of a common question. There was another one. No. Yeah.
More of a comment too. I heard that 4:7, Genesis 4:7, with if you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told that those are a helpful way to understand 3:16 better as far as the dysfunction between the relationships between men and women. That there, at least that the word desire between the two is identical in the Hebrew. And the desire being not a good desire, and then ruling over it. Well, you don't rule gently over sin. You don't have headship over sin.
Mm-hmm.
You're being tyrannical and forceful against it.
Right. Right. So tyrannical rule of superiors to inferiors.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's a helpful way to understand
right.
What 3:16 is really saying.
Yeah, that's good. The language is the exact same. Yeah. Ron.
Question. How do we distinguish whether a frustration in work is designed by God to get us to our eyes of what I mentioned before, how much of it is just we are spoiled at the point where we don't even remember the history of the earth? Many of the people have died and toiled trying to bring crops, the gospel in our own country. And we do it in this culture, we have everything at our fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
We think a frustration is something that ignores our desire at work or something like that. Or what's really, like a little spoiled child. It's not really a problem. come on that way. So how do we distinguish when it's something God is introducing to us? Whether it's just when the street's silly, obnoxious, and spoiled.
How do you distinguish between how much of the frustration is, you might say, God-given or just us being silly? I think at core, the frustration is parallel. Where does the frustration come from? It's part of the things are not, you might say, that the reality that things are not as they're meant to be. Whether it's something we really ought not to be that concerned about. I didn't get a new, new suit for Christmas and I really wanted it. Frustration. I think that the core there is pointing you in the same direction. Things are not as they ought to be. You know, maybe we should be rebuked for a bunch of that, probably. I don't think I'm exactly grabbing your question.
If it happens to you, it's silly.
That's good, Tom. Not particularly clarifying, but yeah, Matt.
I think I can reflect with Ron and how I've experienced it. When do I make an idol out of job satisfaction versus when do I see the discomfort of my current position as yearning to use the gifts, the desires, and the skills that God has given me more effectively to bring His kingdom to earth?
Because
I certainly struggle with that a lot. I was taught in school, the best job is the job you have. Meaning, you can always run from job to job, but
right.
until you fight to choose to bring goodness to your current work environment, to the people that you do work with, rather than always looking for the job that never fulfills itself, then you're in trouble. But I do think that we have an obligation to use the gifts, use the blessings, use the skills and desires that we have been uniquely given to glorify God.
Yeah, so that helps me get my hands around it a little bit more. I think probably a few questions would help with that of what do you do with the frustration? Does it press you to envy? Does it press you to jealousy? Does it press you to continually yearn for more? And so you just can't stay settled at one job. It's probably pushing you to this is silly. There's a place where, yes, you are frustrated, but what's it driving you to do? And then now, I think that becomes a wisdom question because sometimes it is good to swap jobs if you can. But if you can't, what do you do with it? I think would probably be the best way to answer that. So we're going to have to close down here and grab a coffee and stretch your legs and come back. So why don't you just go ahead and do that and we'll pray back in the service. All right. Next week, I think we're going to look at the history of work. So sort of tracing how people viewed work throughout the ages up to today.